With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Derek.
And I'm Ray.
I'm Alex Reed.
And welcome back to another episode of
Mostly Lit.
Hello guys, and welcome back to another episode. Ray's back in the building. She's back. I would introduce my co-host, but we all know who he is.
Well, I'm here.
Thank you guys so much for listening, obviously. And I've been away for a bit, but now I'm back. Today we're missing another limb, but...
Missing a limb, but you know.
That's fine.
We continue.
It's so weird because every time I'm not here, I always say, like, when I'm here and one of you guys aren't here, I'm always like, oh, we're missing a limb. The last two episodes I've listened. I got no shout out.
You're a liar. Actually,
first of all, the last when episode, we have the legend.
No, the last episode.
I didn't get a shout out.
Do you know why? Because, number one, it started late because they were stuck in traffic. So they basically, we actually don't have time. We had to just run into the episode. Yeah. So it was really difficult.
But the episode before that, we were basically shouting you out.
Hey, oh, she's in Essence Fest, living her best life, saying
for
hi
like
to all
the
these
first
people.
5 seconds.
It wasn't even 5 seconds. You were brought up throughout the show, please.
Oh, that is
a lie. You're a liar.
But
you didn't even listen to the show, did you?
You guys are incredible for like having Dabba Mandela on.
That was amazing. That was
a I literally listened to that ep. And I was super jealous.
It's like
that
his voice just came from the pits
of
South Africa.
It was incredible. It was it was an amazing episode as well when you guys were talking about forgiveness and you were like, oh God. talking about forgiveness, talking about violence and peace and HIV struggle in South Africa and other parts of Africa. So well done, guys.
Like, I'm still working on my colonial forgiveness.
Such an amazing episode.
It's growth.
And I'm sad that I couldn't be here, but it was also a great chance to listen as well. Yeah. So, yeah.
But you were out and about doing what you were doing. Tell us about Essence Fest, because you've not actually come on and spoken about it.
I know.
So how was it?
Oh, my God, guys. Essence Fest in New Orleans was incredible. First of all, obviously, I got to see so many people. I bumped into Asante from the Friend Zone podcast, and I was so nervous. But my friend Tolu was like, "Ray, just go up," and I was like, "Wait, like you know me, I don't really like going up to people because I'm so part of it is pride, and second of all, it's it's like these people aren't like." I don't want to come up to you because I'm like, do you know what I mean?
It's weird, yeah.
It's just so weird. Anyway, so I also saw Insecure.
Issa Rae.
I saw her like literally just walking down Bourbon Street and people were surrounding her, but she didn't really want pictures. I don't think she really wanted to talk to anyone. And me and my friend were just like following behind stalkers. And she literally is smaller than I imagined.
Oh.
And she's just like a regular girl, you know?
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
And, oh, stunning. And other stunning people like Regina Hall. Oh.
Oh, wow.
My goodness.
Legend.
I saw her in a panel, the Hate U Give panel, which was just we were literally like at the front, and I was like, wow, these people are beautiful. And my favorite thing about Essence was they did quite a lot of women empowerment panels, and one of them was one with Queen Latifah, mm-hmm. Mary J. Blige.
Oh, what a...
I know. And a woman from Planned Parenthood. And, oh, God. Oh, I forgot her name. How can I forget her name? This is
what, is she a singer?
No, Reclaiming My Time.
Reclaiming My Time. Maxine Waters.
Maxine Waters. That's the one. And it was a panel on sister love, mm-hmm. and how to support one another. Oh, sorry. Mary J. Blige, Queen Latifah, Maxine Waters, and... Oh my god! Oh my
what
god!
What
rapper! Oh rapper, my god! Rapper. How
kind of,
how
kind of
am
rapper?
I?
Female rapper.
Female rapper, obviously. Okay, so, Papoose.
Remy Ma.
Remy Ma. I'm really bad with names.
Wow.
I'm so bad with names because
I'm like, oh my god.
Anyway, so literally like legends, like they were just there and they were talking about sister love, and they were talking about, and Queen Latifah started crying, talking about her relationship that she has with her mother, and her relationship that she has with Mary, and Mary J was like sniffing back tears, and Maxine Waters was just giving me all of this Mama Bear vibes and talking about how important it is for us to support one another as women, as sisters, as black women specifically, because there's just a lot of infrastructure that isn't there to support us, and how are we going to move forward? So I was nearly in tears on that panel, and you know me, like, I'm not really a panel person. I'd rather be on the panel rather than watch it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know.
And to just sit back and take in stuff, because a lot of the times we forget that our soul needs feeding.
This is it.
And we just go on life thinking that we're fed, we're good, but we really need to actively take time to feed our soul, because for when sure. I walked out, I was like, whoa.
If it doesn't enrich you, like, it needs to enrich you, then like events like that, like Essence Fest and other black events, those are really, really like amazing places, because you're just in spaces where you don't necessarily have to feel any kind of like alienation.
Absolutely.
In one sense.
There's so many black people. I was
so
like,
black people
what?
Just everywhere.
I was like, what? Like, the whole city was filled with black people, and it was...
Apparently, there are so many more people this
oh,
year.
Absolutely, because Girls Trip really, like, it really... the women wearing tops saying Girls Trip, it was like, phenomenal. So, yeah, guys, I would really recommend next year, like, better collect your coin and save up and go bring your whole family, because it really is a family motive. It's a friend motive. It's everything. So I would really recommend it.
Good.
So that's me. How's your week been, Alex? You've been living your life.
I've been living my best life.
Yeah.
Came off the Eurostar on Monday evening.
Uh-huh. Where were you?
I was in Paris. I'm living my life in Paris. Went to Afropunk Paris.
Yeah.
Saw SZA on stage.
SZA.
Yeah, Damian Marley, Maxwell.
Oh, she went. I thought she had a throat.
Do you know
problem.
What? I was really, really. I was saying to my friend, I'm gonna be so disappointed in her if she comes on and it's not, and she's not at the level. Not because she should. I wanted her to come back well. I didn't want her to rush going back into touring, because I know that she was at Lovebox the day before she meant to be at Afropunk Paris. So, but when she came on, she was like brilliant. Like, she did what she had to do. She's very like, she's like a black valley girl.
Like,
I was like, oh my god.
I can't believe she was a former hijabi. That's what I was like.
And
really,
like, she kind of puts it into her music as well. And she was brilliant. Mr. Easy was there.
Yeah.
Mr. Easy was there. So we're getting our Afrobeat life one. And David and Davido, or David, however you say his name.
Davido.
Yeah, he was there. And like, it was brilliant. It was an amazing, amazing event. Like, you know, just again, just being back in Paris, it was amazing.
Being
black in Paris, like, you know, that was great. And again, it's as you said, about kind of like enriching your soul.
Absolutely.
In those places, because you know, you're just with good people,
with
good music. It's just good vibes all around. It was just a peaceful
Speaking
time.
Speaking of that, there is and no go on. Sorry.
I was gonna say, like, and then also Paris, and then France won the World Cup, and
it all just went
mad. The whole country, the whole city was on fire, flames. And it was brilliant. Like, it was an electric kind of energy. It was a good way for me to kind of say, I need to take this time out.
Absolutely.
And skin out in the park.
Skin out in
and
the
just,
park.
Like, I was in shorts
skin
all
out.
Weekend. Shorts all weekend.
Yeah.
Like, leg out the door. Everything was just good. I had the Hennessy. I had the JD.
Okay.
I had the rum. It was crazy.
Wow, your liver really felt it.
They really felt it that weekend.
Yeah.
I came back and I was like, oh, what did I do to myself? So I've literally been sitting down. Any Jamaican would know about bitters. Yeah. So I've been sitting down drinking bitters each morning to kind of cleanse my blood and my soul.
And this weekend you're going to do it all over again.
I mean.
Living your best life.
We're out here to use our body. Absolutely. Do you see what I mean? So yeah. I may as well. But it was a great weekend. So shout out to everybody that went, you know.
I know, there's quite a few people I saw online. Yeah,
I was out there with Uncle Timmy and...
From Nerd Council.
The Nerd Council. We were out here making waves in this place. But it was really good. And some other of my friends as well.
Yeah, in terms of that idea of... I feel like we've both like been to places that have really enriched our souls. Mm. And my friend reminded me of... told me about this idea, this Greek word called eudaimonia. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. And it also known as eudaimonism. And it's a Greek word which refers to a state of having a good indwelling spirit or being in a sort of contented state of being healthy, happy and prosperous. And like in moral philosophy, eudaimonia is also like referred to, is used to refer to the right actions as like, those that result in the well-being of yourself and as an individual. And there's different schools of philosophy whereby they'd say, like, well, Aristotle was like, there are two things. You need to be both inwardly happy, but you also need to be in surroundings that uphold that happiness and uphold the values and almost strengthen the values that you hold inside. Mm. Whereas then you have like other people who would say, well, actually this virtue, especially Stoics, they'd say that this type of virtue and happiness shouldn't really be about outside places, should come from within. However, I agree with Aristotle in that there needs to be a balance between inward values and inward things, but then also your surroundings, which is why it's very important to put yourself into places and go to Paris and, you know, mm-hmm. New Orleans and places that uphold these values. And I've literally been absolutely going crazy researching this idea of eudaimonia and what it means to be happy, healthy, content, prosperous.
Eudaimonia.
And I think it's absolutely important. And I think that anything you do, like, it's so weird because when I was younger, I used to always go on panels and do all of these different things to give me this, that feeling, that flutter inside when you just feel whole, when you feel like you've just had some food for the soul, right? Mm. And as you get older, you stop that because you're too busy living life. But I think it's when we get older that we need to continue doing that to make mm-hmm. sure that we do that regularly and it's something that we do that often. So yeah, eudaimonia, guys, go out and feed your soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go out and do it, man. Go out and do it and travel. I've been looking at Eurostar tickets for September. I'm trying to leave.
Do it.
I'm trying to get out. I try to get away, but I'm trying to figure out what's about solo travel as well, because I'm thinking that I've traveled places alone.
Yeah.
Before. But, like, you know, for a purpose, whether it be going out to teach abroad or going out to study or whatnot, that's traveling a lot. But I want to actually go somewhere by myself and then actually discover things and people around there. So I'm really figuring out how I'm gonna do that.
Yeah.
And stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
I'll be when you see my Instagram and I'm out here.
Alex travels, guys. Alex travels.
Alex travels.
See, Alex reads.
Alex travels.
Alex writes. Alex travels.
Alex is out here.
Alex Alchia. I love it. Okay, so tell us what you've been reading, Alex.
This week, I've been reading...
I haven't recorded with you in a while, so I want to know everything.
Oh, yeah, you're hearing everything. You better listen back to the episode. I've been reading this week, actually, a book called The Stranger on the Bridge. Mm-hmm. And it's written by a mental health campaigner called Johnny Benjamin. So back in 2008, he escaped. He ran away from the hospital that he was in. That was kind of, I forgot what it was, but he has a form of schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. So he kind of escaped from the hospital. He said he needed to break out. And he found himself on Waterloo Bridge.
Okay.
You know, ready to jump and commit suicide. It was a very busy day in January. And a man came up to him and started talking to him and sat with him and started talking to him and talked him off the bridge. Eventually got him off. But as soon as he got him off the bridge, the ambulance, the police took Johnny and they took him away. And then he was on a process of recovery and it kind of spurred his recovery to kind of, you know, like he still has schizophrenia, still has depression and these things. But it kind of spurred that process. But then in 2015, he set out on a mission to find this guy because he didn't remember who he was.
Yeah.
And he set up on a mission called, and he did this whole thing. It was on British, he was on Breakfast TV. He was all over the world, everything, trying to find, he called it hashtag finding Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was, and handed out flyers on the bridge trying to find this guy. Everyone stopping him because he had a documentary on Channel 4 trying to find him.
Yeah.
And yeah, he ends up finding him, and it was like, his name was Neil, but he ends up finding him. And now, but since then, it's kind of like spurred this kind of like thing where he, you know, he goes through universities, talks about mental health, goes to schools, campaigns. He's been co-signed by the Duke of Cambridge, and he's done all these different talks everywhere. And in the book, it basically chronicles his life from like his childhood up until now, and like, you know, how he felt when he was at university and what, you know, the mental health system was like then. Because I think university, he was probably, 2008 he was at uni, you know, just a few years before I went and whatnot. And it was just an amazing story. Like, it's an amazing story, and it's just so emotive. And he's got little excerpts of his diary and things like when he started writing when he was like 10 and then 14, and kind of talks about the music he listened to. So like, he's gay, and he didn't really he didn't know how to kind of deal with that level of his sexuality on top of his mental health issues, on top of all the pressures that he had at school and all that stuff. And he talked about like how he loved Madonna, and like, you know, he tried to kind of to tone down his flamboyancy and all this different stuff. But then it was an interesting process. His mental health kind of, as he grew older and his mental health kind of intensified, he kind of started listening to like Amy Winehouse and Billie Holiday and Whitney Houston. And then it was just, he like found it kind of weird how he ended up listening to people who had really tough and difficult lives themselves. Very interesting book.
Drawn to the energy, right?
Yeah, very interesting books. Very interesting book. Very interesting guy.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm reading, The Stranger on the Bridge. It came out in May by Bluebird.
Yeah.
But I guess if you guys want to read it, or even watch a documentary, I think it's still on 4OD.
Yeah.
Have a watch. Like, it was it's a very moving story. Very moving story.
Great. Wow.
Sorry.
That just really
it's really great.
Sent it low, right?
No, it didn't send it low, but it's just a really good book. Like, it doesn't have to be depressing. Do you see what I mean? Like, it's one of those motivating stories, because what it does show, it shows that the impacts of human kindness.
Absolutely.
And the kindness of strangers is still there. Do you see what I'm saying?
It's like, true. You know, my Uber driver lied to me today because he didn't have integrity.
What?
That's not kind. Yeah, he was literally like, yeah, I'll get you to recording in time. And then I said, are you sure? And he goes, yeah. And then he took the long route, and then he was in traffic. And then midway through, he realized his mistake and stopped talking to me. Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah, no integrity. I'm finished.
So anyways, I'm reading two books. I'm reading the Pulitzer Prize winner, Andrew Sean Greer's book Less, which kind of tells the story of a struggling novelist who like travels the world to avoid going to an awkward wedding of his like ex, but not ex, and it's quite hilarious, and the narrator is really, really funny. I'm reading that, and I kind of don't know. I mean, there's been hype, but I don't believe the hype, because as I'm reading it, I'm like a quarter way through, and it's not living up to the hype as of right now. But what really lives up to the hype is a reread that I'm rereading from my university days. And I read Patricia Hill Collins's Black Feminist Thought when I was in my final year of university reading for my feminisms module. And we were talking about black feminisms, and this wasn't required reading, but it was just reading that I was doing around the subject because I was quite interested in it.
Hermione Granger.
And I absolutely love this book because it really gives you a kind of academic introduction into black feminism and black feminist thought. However, I do think the downside of it is that it is quite African-American focus. So there is a lot of African-American feminists and women and theory, and the struggle is looked at through the lens of what it means to be an African-American woman. And it does delve in what it means to be an African woman a little bit. However, there is a bit of a gap with the I guess the black British woman perspective, which is I think An identity that has existed in a while, but hasn't really been spoken about in the academic and intellectual sphere like that. Yeah. However, I do think if you really want a good introduction into Black feminisms, apart from reading the actual philosophers and the actual black women who have written on the subject, if you want to get an overview, then this is a really good book to read. It's called Black Feminist Thought by Patricia Hill Collins. And yeah, read it with a bit, obviously, if you are a British woman, read it with a bit of, gap, because you'll be encountering a gap. So yeah, that's what I'm reading, guys. And
what do you mean a gap?
Read it with a gap. Like, okay, there's a gap that won't be filled, but it's okay. Just read it, taking into consideration that gap.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's get started.
Right. So this week we have Who's Lit?
Who is Lit?
So I came across this story of this young woman called Shina West. And she's basically been, tipped as a young martial artist who's chopping anxiety out of her life. She basically went through a very tumultuous relationship. It doesn't specify whether it was a romantic one or not, but she said it was a very difficult relationship. And she's basically been using martial arts to kind of overcome her anxiety.
Yeah.
And when she was first diagnosed with anxiety after the relationship, she was prescribed with medication, didn't like the medication. So she basically found a new way to kind of put herself, to manage the anxiety. So yeah. I think she found a new energetic output. So she said, anxiety is often spoken about as a mental health issue, but I was experiencing very intense physical symptoms of it. And she said, after being prescribed medication, she actually stayed on it for a while, but with no prevail. And slowly but surely, I've come across a few methods and small understandings in my own way of what my anxiety is. So the reason I picked her is because it's having that agency and taking it to be like, I'm going to control what's happening up here.
Mm.
And she decided that, this medication's not going to control me and control my life and control the way that I perceive, the world. It's not going to numb my senses, but I'm going to take control of it by finding a different energy, a different way to kind of exert whatever's going on inside me. And I found that really, really inspiring. So I'm going to say that Shina West is lit. She is down in Brixton.
Yeah.
So, yeah, shout out to you, Shana.
Go, girl.
Do your thing.
Do your thing. I was actually going on about
a popping afro.
That afro is banging.
Love it.
I was actually talking about medication and medicating mental health issues online. I find it's so weird because obviously I think if you have a balance, a lot of psychiatrists and psychotherapists will say that, it depends on your own circumstances, but some people, they have a balance of talking therapies and medication. And it's so weird that I can accept talking therapies as a way to deal with mental health issues. But because mental health it can be so intangible, especially if it's not on an extreme scale. So if you're not seeing it, then it's almost like it's not there, right? Mm-hmm. However, when you feel pain, like if you have a headache, or if you have a broken arm, or even if you have cramps, like you understand it, the world understands that you've been educated in it, so that you are aware that as soon as these things happen, you run to that medicine cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like when you realize, oh shit, okay, I have to start taking something, either for if it's depression or anxiety or anything, you start thinking, oh, but I could will myself out of feeling bad. I was thinking this in the weekend. I was like, oh, well, I can will myself. And then I was like, oh my God, like that's very wild to even though to be so aware about mental health issues and to advocate for the changes and safe spaces and for people to feel comfortable in it, you still talk yourself out of taking actual medication because it's still something that's so intangible that you're questioning whether it's real or not.
Yeah.
Which I think the conversation still needs to change because it's still not where I think it should be.
Yeah,
definitely. And I think it should start very early on, because
it should really start.
Nobody spoke to me about mental health issues until I was like very old.
Yeah.
I went through the whole schooling system, but they told you about periods. at the right time.
Because you can see
and puberty. They told you about
tangible
science and you know, illnesses. So yeah, I think we need to really have that open space about mental health.
If you can find a way to cope, like Shayna did.
Yeah.
Do it. Okay. So should we head on to
So this week, guys, we have chosen.
What was all that about?
Actually, Alex has chosen because I chose something else. Oh, would you actually have a strep seal?
No, I'm not giving you a strep seal. Out here coughing on the mic.
Ouch, yeah. We're coughing on the mic.
I don't know what you're doing, but it's embarrassing.
Cringe. I'm really happy. Can't a girl be happy? Anyway, today we are discussing what it means when a man falls from the sky by the incredible Leslie Neka Arima, who was born in the UK, raised in Nigeria, and currently resides in Minneapolis in the USA. She is the winner of the 2015 Commonwealth Short Story Prize for Africa, and she's also been shortlisted twice for the Kane Prize. Amazing. Incredible, fantastic, outstanding.
All the superlatives.
All of them.
This is what I was doing all weekend. Amazing, fantastic, super, energetic.
Outstanding, incredible.
All the superlatives.
So we'll be going through her debut short story work, and we'll be talking about it. We'll read, like, inviting you guys to really send in your comments if you've read it. And if you haven't read it, stop this episode right now. Go and pick it up. Go and read it. And then continue.
I mean,
there'll be spoilers.
Yeah, there will be spoilers, but you know.
I mean, you can, if you have no interest in reading this book, actually, just listen.
Just listen, and we'll see. We'll go through it.
Yeah. So,
first of all, overall thoughts on the book, then.
Yes, Alex, go on.
So, overall thoughts. Basically, I loved this book when I first read it. It was visceral. It had everything that. I love short stories, so I liked the honing into little aspects of people's lives, and then just that when something very, very pertinent happens.
Absolutely.
And then it ends.
Yeah.
The way she writes is very, very magical, I have to say. We're going to go through some of the stories in a bit, but there are some stories in there that really, really challenge myth and the kind of the way that we perceive it. And she does kind of come across really well as like, a griot.
Yes.
And you can just imagine her sitting there telling you these stories, sitting down and just telling you them. And one thing that's important about this book also as well is that she doesn't focus on race/ethnicity. It's just, it is what it is. You will get the name of the character. The character will more than likely be Nigerian, and that is it. That's all you're getting.
She's writing, so my overall view is that, so this is my first ever compilation of short stories that I read from beginning to end. I read it in order, and it's the first body of work that I have finished of short stories. I wasn't really a fan of short stories before, mainly because I never actually read them. So for me, it was just something different that I didn't know about, and I didn't really immerse myself in it. Therefore, what I don't know, I say I don't like, because I'm childish like that, which is what everyone does.
I mean,
hey, it's ignorance.
Some.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Anyways, so this body of work is basically a compilation of stories that explores the different ties that bind people, binding parents, friends, grandparents, husband, wives, loved ones and strangers, house girls, and it ties them all in, and I say a specific location, a specific place that either one or the other could call home or maybe not home. And she does write a lot about, I think, what she knows. She's obviously a Nigerian woman, so a lot of the things that she wrote about, a lot of characters were placed in Nigeria. A lot of experiences were based on that first generation migrant self, where
you've
moved abroad, and it's that the diasporic identity mixed with the home identity mixed with the magical identity. So a lot of the story, there was stories of home, you know, stories of relationships bound to home, and then there were the magical stories that I was like, that didn't even have a place in the world,
didn't,
but it just was in your imagination. And I think her talent is She is able to string your imagination, pull these strings from different corners of your mind, put them in a linear order, and you're still like, what?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think the mere fact of being able to do that is just pure talent.
I think that it's really strange when it comes to, not strange, but I do think it's very interesting to look at when you've got African diasporic texts, or even diasporic texts, and they are in short story form. They tend to do they tend to have those topics of back home, elsewhere, belonging, mysticism. And yeah, just you saying that now is kind of like triggered in my mind. Like all some other short stories that I've read and reading and seen, a lot of them are just based upon, you know, your position and your belonging. I find that really interesting when it comes to diaspora.
I think it's because it's the topic is very particular. So when I'm not saying that an artist should write all that they know, and I think it's very important for artists to write things that they don't know about, or to write from experiences that they've never had, because that's the imagination. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's how it's supposed to work. But for example, the Western white identity does not have that idea of being pulled from a different place, or doesn't have the idea of your country being ruled from a different, you know, history of colonialism, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It might have more of an entrepreneurial enterprise type of identity, whereby it could be a normal story of Sarah going abroad to visit her expat grandfather in Italy and then going home. And that in itself is an identity, because it shows you, okay, these people have done this, they have a place that they're very firmly rooted in, a place of home, which they do just fine, and they're going on holiday to do this, whereby one of the stories here is one of my favorite stories actually from this collection, Light, where a father is struggling to raise a fiery, independent, amazing daughter. And one of the reasons why he's struggling, I guess, is because his wife is getting an education in the United States.
Right. So, okay. So we're going to go into the stories then.
I love Light.
May as well go through there. So through Light. So you saw it as that.
No. Not all. Like, for me, Light was...
So what's the story?
Okay. So Light is a young father, Mbele, I think. And basically, he narrates the story of his daughter and how he views his daughter. And his daughter is this, you know, independent spirit. She's wild and she's not yet corrected by the woes of the world, I guess. And she's just growing. And in the end, well, his wife goes to America to study and get an education, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he sees his daughter growing up, his relationship with her, and he sees the relationship with the daughter and the mother, and how strained it is because of distance, because of the mere fact that she's not there to see her grow up. And everybody, I think, is trying to tame the young girl. And her father is, I think, very worried that the world will correct her, that the world will dampen. He says that, you know, when she wrote that, she writes a love letter to a boy and gets in trouble at school. And all the teachers tell him, you know, you must make sure that you discipline her. And he's like, she is his brightest ember and he would not have her dimmed. And to me, that imagery of this young girl as this burning light, this fire, this flame, and her, the world telling her that she must dim herself a little. Her father's worried about that.
I just really enjoyed it because I felt like the bond that because we talk about a lot about the mother and daughter bond and mother and children bond, regardless. But, you know, the fathers, they don't tend to, they have to curate that bond a lot stronger they have to work a lot harder.
I guess there's an insecurity.
So, for example, when we talked to Gabby about her father and stuff, and he's like, as she grew older, they grew closer because she was no longer a child, she was an adult. But in this story, in Light, it's like he didn't want her to be corrected, he didn't want her to be anything, he just wanted her to be his daughter.
Yeah.
And what I found in this story, it was the mother's and it was the wives. He's like, that you know, there was a bit there, I just seen where she was like, when she got there to America, and she's like, oh, daddy makes me breakfast.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, why is your daddy making you breakfast? You're old enough to make you should be cooking. You know what I mean? So it was a very interesting story, kind of like to see that the strength of the mother, but also like the fieriness of the child is dampened by the mother.
Yeah.
In the sense, rather than by her dad, who you would expect it to be like, oh, go, yeah, you should go and cook. Yeah. Like, you're my daughter, cook for me kind of
but,
thing.
That's kind I mean, of what I you would expect. I think that's easily explainable because so her mother is trying to get her in order, saying that like, you should do your hair properly, you should learn to cook and stuff. And I think it's because that she has also been dampened. And she even says, like, well, in you know the words of Leslie, who says, why doesn't she see that I'm trying to ease her transition? And I think it is that transition from being a fiery, independent child, not even a child, but just a fiery individual, an individual who is without the shards of society and the teachings that turn you into a woman, and what that identity of being a modern day woman mm-hmm. looks like. And her mother is trying to ease her into that transition, like be a woman that is palatable to men, be a woman that submits, be a woman that cooks and cleans and does all do your role, essentially. Don't be this other thing that I do not know how to manage because I have also been taught this way. And it really reminds me of what's it called? I actually wrote it down. It's a poem by Audre Lorde and I love it. I told you guys to read it. I don't know if you have. It's called How to Raise a Woman. No, it's not called How to Raise a Woman. Anyway, it's basically, she says that instead of a letter of congratulations upon your book and your daughter when you say you are who you say you are raising to be, a correct little sister. And he explores the fears of raising the daughters in the past and with the antiquated views of like internalized misogyny, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And one thing that Audre Lorde writes is, for I am already a sister corrected, already raised up. We are landscapes, Tony, printed upon them as securely as water etches feather on stone. So it's, I think, I almost feel sorry for the mother because she has already been corrected. She's had her light dimmed and she just wants her daughter to be put in place.
She's just doing what she knows.
Yeah.
Doing what she knows.
But that bond between father and daughter was just beautiful.
Because like, you could feel the lament, like you could feel the pain
yeah.
in it. But was it, I don't know, I'm trying to think, is that the story? Is that the story where when she's born, like the grandparents are saying, actually, wait.
No, that's not that one.
Not that one.
Okay, I think you're thinking of Glory.
No, that's a different one, yeah.
Yeah, this one where the end shifts and the narration shift and Leslie does it really beautifully, where he kind of sits there imagining what his daughter will be like when she goes to America, and the changes that will overcome her and how she transitions between a Nigerian girl to a Nigerian woman living in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the flip, I think, in narration, where he's literally just sat somewhere telling us how it's going to happen. Oh, when I see this and I see this, and it's almost like, and then it happens.
Yeah.
And I think that was so cool. Yeah. Kind of reminds me of the end of Things Fall Apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was just done.
So sudden.
Yeah. It was done beautifully.
But that's kind of like the rhythm of life really, isn't it? Like you have the moments where you have anticipation until something happens.
And then it's all of a sudden it changes.
It's like, boom.
Yeah.
Right. This is it now. How do we deal with that? Kind of thing, but I like that story.
I love that story. That was
not my favorite.
What's your favorite? Let's come on to your favorite.
So, which one was my favorite? I did like Wild.
Oh, I just like Wild. Don't talk about Volcano because that's my favorite.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about him. But
Wild. Okay, Wild. Talk about Wild.
Wild was interesting because
what's Wild about?
So Wild was about, I'm trying to get her name.
I don't think they mention it.
They don't mention names in there. But anyway, a young woman is sent to Nigeria before she goes to university in the States. She hates it. She's like, why are you sending me to Nigeria?
She has bickering with her mom.
Bickering with her mom, whatever. So my mom sends her to Nigeria because to iron her out. Put her straight.
Basically.
For a bit.
Every parent used to have that. And like, I hate that. The idea of using back home as this weapon.
Yeah.
It really
like, but it's
just,
more like, but I feel like it's more go back home or sure. go to this place.
And see poverty, and see how people live.
I don't think it's that even. I think it's go back to this place, get some grounding. And humble yourself.
I don't know. It's more so like, yeah, but where's that humility coming from? Like, see how people live, see how hard it can get, and then come back here, like, corrected.
Like, yeah, before I go back into the story, but like, when you're, the way I always saw it was always like, okay, so when you're growing up here, say in the United Kingdom or the United States or whatever,
the West, yeah.
You're in the West even, you're very, very like consumed around everything. Everything you can get straight away. You can go out, you can go here, you can go there, you can drink, you can go there, you go to university, you go to school, you go to parties, all these different things. And while you can do that back home, it's saying, go back home to get that context so we don't lose you.
But where is that context coming from? Is that context something that is primitive almost? Or are we looking at it as just something that is different?
I never look at it.
Because there's a fine line between go home, because a lot of the times what, they don't. I used to get that threat a lot, and it's go home, like, oh, you know, if you don't, you know, we'll send you back home, and then you're gonna miss all of these opportunities, and then you'll see how, and I used to always get, you'll see how people actually live, because, you know, there is that struggle, and like, I think they want you to be hardened by that
struggle.
I never looked at it as
these people live. Do you know what I mean? Like, anybody that grows, like, the level of maturity that you're at, you're gonna know that you have it good where you are. You know what I mean? Like, you may be poor in this country, but poor in this country is a different
very different to poor in elsewhere,
one.
Yeah.
So she goes back to Nigeria, and she goes to stay with her cousin and her aunt.
Who are quite well off. They have a driver.
Well off. I mean,
they have a driver?
I feel like it's, I think it's...
No, they don't have a driver.
Okay, so in Jamaica, we have a driver. But it's not a driver as in, like, they're employed to us. Does that make any sense?
They're not employed.
It's a taxi man. It's a taxi guy, but they know the family.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So it's not like, oh, we have a driver. Like, this is, you know, whatever, man. And then he's driving us around. But it would be a family, someone who knows the family, and he would drive us. But so that's what I thought it was in that story. But she goes there, and she basically finds herself trying to relate to her cousin.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Trying to find...
He's had a baby out of wedlock.
He's had a baby. That you don't realize that until
really?
Partway through the story.
Of
no, because
you do.
No, because you look at the baby.
I realized it the moment they mentioned it.
There's this baby, yeah. There's this baby in the story.
Come on, you know, because they talk about her, the whispering,
being called
the
brother.
The moment she goes in and the baby's crying and the cousin takes the baby and...
I thought it was her sibling.
No, but that's... Oh, come on, Ali.
I thought it was her sibling. I actually thought it was her sibling. I was like, okay, so there's this baby there. I understand. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you're going to have... I understood our age gaps. I was like, okay, so you got this older sister who's looking after the child, who's very much like, you know, I mean, I understand there's this big age gap.
You need to read the story again.
And I was like, I'm reading again with a different view now. Because I'd be like, so when I read that, and I was like, oh shit, it's the child. Wow.
Yeah, the mother's referring to the baby as your brother because
that's what I mean. So I will look at it like that.
She doesn't want the world to know.
I look at it like that, but that's what I mean. When I start reading stories, I kind of take them at face value a lot of the time because I run with the protagonist. I'm like, yeah, this is what protagonist is seeing. But then so she's like, it's about how the protagonist is with her cousin and figuring out there's all these different family dramas that happened before her mum left and her dad left the country.
Yeah, so they go to a party.
And they go to a party. Is it a ball or something? Or I'd say it's a party.
I think it was a hall party, essentially. African hall parties. Yeah. So basically, she goes to live with her aunt and cousin for a few weeks in the summer.
Chinere was the cousin's name.
Chinere. And Chinere is, you know, she's a wild child. Like, she does what she wants. But at the same time, there's this richness in her. I think this collection of books is all about young women who do not want to be pinned down. And Tenere, like, she's another wild one, but her wildness, she knows her wildness. She's aware of it, I think. And she does whatever the hell she wants. And they go, she's like, you know, tell mom that you want to go out with the car. Because if I ask her, she'll say no. And then the cousin, like, does that. And they go to this hall party where there is this woman who I think was very much in love with her father before her father went to the States with her mum and before she was born. And she was kind of alluding to this family drama that happened before. And the narrator was feeling very uncomfortable. And Chinera, like... she went off basically with some guy and then ended up ditching her cousin to go home. So this young woman was left by herself, the narrator. And what I love about the story is it's actually just all about family and family ties and the very big, strong bonds that bind black families without the black. Because when you're with your family, you're just my mum. But when other people are talking about it in the intellectual space of novels and writing, it's, you know, the black family. Mm. You know, it's, you know, stay there in Africa, you know? Do you know what I mean? And it's that rubbish. But here it's like, I think what Leslie is amazing at is illustrating that bond between families and the mess. And how sometimes beautiful that mess is, you know?
Even
though it can feel ill.
She goes to this whole party. And she's like, and she meets this woman called Grace. What's it? Grace.
Auntie Grace, who drives her home in the end.
It's so funny.
Auntie Grace is a hater.
Auntie Grace is a hater. Like, I knew your father, you know. He was a godly man.
He was before he married your mother.
He went off to America. I was like, and she's there drunk.
Drinking. I know.
She's drinking her sorrows.
And she's just lamenting on the guy, the one that got away.
That's the thing, but like the story is really big on, you know, who suffers because of the parents. Do you see what I mean? Mm. So it's basically, so she went to the hall party with Chinere. Chinere is basically trying to elevate herself because she doesn't want to be where she's from. She doesn't want to be in this kind of class society. She's trying to do social climbing. She's trying to do a one
social
moving
mobility
through these things. And she just left
her cousin
there in the place. And then
Auntie Grace
brings her back in this car, all shrouded in shame. The protagonist doesn't really feel shame. She's just like, well, I just need to get back home, to be honest. But Chinere gets really reprimanded.
So she should have, fam.
It's really reprimanded. Phone taken away, all these different things. But you're treating this girl like...
I think she should have. If I was her mother, I'd be like, you should have.
But you're treating this girl like a child. Like,
she's acting like one. I didn't like to know.
But there's a level of rebellion that people, that young people have against their families when they're not given...
I totally get it, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's either, what somebody said, when you're given too much space, you rebel. When you're not given that much space, you rebel harder, or something really strange. But she's been rebelling, and like this.
Yeah, I mean, she had a whole baby out of wedlock.
She had a baby out of wedlock.
That her family are trying to hide.
Trying to hide and all these different things. And like, you know, she's constantly feel like her freedoms are constantly restricted and all of that stuff.
She's a girl that wants to, she's a flower basically. She wants to be free. And she wants to bloom. Yeah,
and she sees her cousin come from the States who has all this level of independence, all this money, all these clothes, and she's not using it.
Yeah.
And like, you know what I mean? And it just makes you angry. So that's kind of why I picked the story, because when you go back home.
Yeah.
And your cousins and your family look at you.
Yeah.
Like, what is that feeling? Because you have this feeling of like, there's a small feeling of like embarrassment, of like, oh well, I have all this stuff. I have this. There's an energy you have from being over here and then going back.
Yeah.
Especially if you're not, well, for me, especially if I'm not born back home, there's a different kind of an energy there.
So I think for me, that was, I felt like that, or people imposed that feeling on me when I was younger, especially like parents. They'd be like, you should feel very lucky. You should feel grateful that you have all of these opportunities and your cousins may not. However, I do think that we need to start looking at the different countries in Africa and the African identity very differently, because when we say that, we are kind of almost admitting that there is the difference is an opportunity. And as much as there is, I think it's very much changing now, especially in the different class systems. So the poverty here is different to poverty in Africa, right?
Yeah.
And my family, I would say the young girls in my family are not restricted from, I don't think opportunity restricts them. One, I think the men restrict them and the misogyny in the cultures and the different people and the society restricts them. So opportunity, I think they could definitely have more on a larger scale because London is global, whereas I think Zanzibar is not, it's not on the map like that, do you know what I mean? So opportunities might not be as global as you might get them here. But at the same time, it's also about, there are multiple factors, but the idea of going back in the day, I did feel ashamed because, oh, why me? Why did my mom send me back to Zanzibar? You know what I mean?
Having things.
But there is also this duty of giving back, which I've written about and spoken about many times, of the first generation, second generation migrant child with this duty of giving back to back home, this idea of back home. And I think the girl in this, she was almost like, but you know how her identity completely changed when she was in the US? She was like, you know, like,
she had a lesbian friend.
Exactly. She's out here. She's chilling. She's doing. She went back home and she just went straight into her shell. She was almost an observer of society and of life rather than a participant
and that's what I do think is the beauty of it, of going back home every so often, because that humility, you do kind of need it, because you get so caught up in the speed of life where you are and everything happening, everything, all these things. But then until you go back home, because I feel like when I went back to Jamaica after 4 or 5 years of not going, I used to go every 2 years. Then I grew older, started working, and I didn't get to go. And then as soon as I went back, I looked at it and I looked at everybody completely differently.
Yeah.
I was like, this is where I'm from.
Yeah.
This is the culture that I come from.
Yeah.
And obviously, because you have that level of understanding from being in London, because obviously the communities and whatnot that are here. But going back there, and you can actually start to look at everything and think, you know, this is... You start to observe naturally just the way you wouldn't act the same way that you do being here, because you're not, because ultimately
you're not immersed in the life.
You're immersed in the life here, but going back home, you can actually see, you just start to look around at things, start to look at what people have, what people don't have, like what you have to do to, you know, necessarily to survive. And you're basically learning all these things. And this is kind of what she was doing when she went to the hall parties. She went to see what that was about.
You think you can get that here? And what is stopping us from getting that here?
Why do we need to get that here? We're here.
No. As in, no. But so you're saying you go back somewhere to understand how people live. However, do the people on the ground, when you know, in Nigeria where this book is set, do the people on the ground have that same view
when they come here?
yeah, when they come here, or when they go, or do they have that same view there? Or is it that we just need somewhere back to go?
Of course they don't have that same, they don't have that same view there at all.
Yeah.
Okay. Because they live there the same way that we don't have that same view here. We're not going to sit down and observe in the same way.
Yeah.
We will walk with that same oblivion of this is my life and this is the country that I'm in.
Yeah, because I just wanted to understand. It was that difference
between
being here and then going elsewhere to get grounding. Mm-hmm. Do the people on the ground there need to go somewhere else to get grounding? No.
Like the thing is, so for example, like if you've got somebody that comes from, you know, Jamaica, Nigeria, wherever, and they come here.
Zanzibar. Thank you.
I mean.
Okay. I'm really tired of not being in the conversation.
I mean, you're kind
Nigeria
of far away.
Nigeria is not the whole of Africa.
You're far away though.
I don't care.
You're like, you're just this remote island.
First of all.
Elsewhere.
Wow.
Far. Indian Ocean, you know. What the fuck? Like, far away.
I'm it's tired fine. Of your shit. It's anyways, fine. Yeah.
I want to go there. I want to swing on a hammock in Zanzibar.
Oh, God. Anyways, what I also wanted to say is Leslie's, I think the idea of being an observant of society rather than being a participant in it, Leslie does it very well in the different narratives that she has because of the places or the narratives where people are moving away and going back and coming forth and going back. You see the observer side of the narration of them very much looking out onto the world and Leslie narrating from almost like a fly on the wall. And then there are those narratives where the protagonist is participating in day-to-day society. I think that's Glory. You know, Glory is the woman
should we
who...
We got two more stories?
Yeah.
Yeah?
So I think...
Should we save the one?
The volcano one. Okay,
and then we can do Glory.
Is Glory the one where this woman is just she's so mediocre?
She literally out here just
doing
what she needs to
do. I absolutely hate that story. I hate it.
I love it.
I read
the
it
story,
and I was like, Glory, you are so you're embarrassing.
Do you know why I like this story? I like the story because she's just real with the whole with it.
No,
all.
She's not.
She doesn't care about shit.
Is she real when she her own Facebook picture? She lies.
Don't start none, won't be none. Is basically what she's doing. She's like, don't start none. Her name is Glory to be got. Glory to God.
I think so.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, she couldn't even have that on Facebook because it wouldn't allow her.
Yeah.
They said it's not a real name.
No, but she's not laughing at that. She's lying. She's lying to everyone around her. But you know what I love about the story is it shows how black women cannot be mediocre because we'll be judged for it. Our good is someone else's outstanding, excellent, fantastic, fabulous, out of this world. That is our good. For you to say, oh, she's doing okay, that woman is probably doing bits. Do you know what I mean? But Glory...
Her name is Glory be to God Ngozi Akunyili.
First of all, come you now. Better put some respect on Glory be to God, yeah?
Glory be to God. Like, her name's Glory anyway. But yeah, Glory works in a call center. Glory works on the ground. She doesn't even work in management. Glory is living off her mum and dad's money. Glory.
No, her mum and dad think that she's something else, no? Well, her parents said that she's doing another job. Basically, she's just lying for the gram. And then...
Glory meets a man called...
I forgot his name, but my man... I actually really like him, but he reminds me of...
Thomas.
He really wanted to... Do you think he wanted to mold her into a specific type of woman? Near the end, yeah.
I don't think... You know what? I think that he...
He just wanted things to work.
Yeah, he really wanted it to work. He's just basically like, I like this girl.
She's a bit...
We're all at this particular age. She's Igbo. I'm Igbo. This is all going to work. This is all great.
And then Thomas's mum comes
Thomas's
through.
Thomas's mum comes out of nowhere and from pleasantness comes down to just like...
Like, oh, so do you want kids? Do you want to move back to Nigeria?
Basically, so Glory...
What do you do?
Yeah, the story basically revolves around Glory, and Glory is an only child.
Glory, like, don't do nothing. She's
only child. She doesn't really have much career projection. She doesn't have... She's still scrounging off her mum.
She is... What's her name? Bridget Jones. Bridget Jones would be acceptable. Like, people will accept Glory if she was white. And all her mediocreness, but because she's a black woman,
but no one doesn't,
and because of the culture that
but
she's
no one
from,
doesn't accept her. This is
no,
what I'm
but
saying.
She's
who doesn't
like,
accept
people
her?
Judge her. Thomas's mum, her own parents judge her
because
always
I mean,
telling her like you could do so much better in life, and therefore
she actually
no,
could.
Therefore she actually could. Glory pissed me off. I was literally reading in this and be like Glory, but then I was like, but then why don't we accept that? And it's the same thing with so much stuff. It just reminds me of like how black women and black people cannot do, cannot write one things that are mediocre. They have to be outstanding, out of this world.
You know what? I had a conversation with my dad this week about legacy. I was, when I say conversation, it was more him telling me. And it was actually quite interesting.
Yeah.
About, like, so reading this story, obviously your parents are going to look at you and be like, hey, I didn't put all this money into you for you to come out here and be scrounging money off me for your rent. Yeah. Okay, where is your money, kind of thing. Like, you know what I mean? You're a big woman at your big age. You're out here getting money from your parents, and she and her mom is giving her money and not telling her dad and all this stuff. And I just find that really, really strange. Where parents are always going to ask, like, always going to want the best for you, you know, legacy wise and all that stuff. Yeah. And they're going to ask these questions. But Gloria was,
to be honest, I have high expectations of people and of myself. So for me to be like, Glory.
But the thing,
but
Glory's had never had anybody to kind of.
No, but she did though.
You know,
Glory's
never had anybody to base herself off of. Do you see what I mean? As an only child, I would imagine, I'm not one, so I don't know, but there, if you don't have many, if you don't have many cousins, if you don't have a huge family around you all the time, you literally don't have any, you don't, there's no soundboard.
So where is that internal thing? For example, I have a big family. But and I definitely am grateful for what they've helped me achieve. But I can honestly say, nobody ever told me to go and do my homework since year four. That was the last time. Yes, there was a food and a shelter and basic things provided that would enable me to be in an environment where I could sit down and do my homework. But where is that internal thing that pushes you? And I think that is what's very different from people to people.
But we need to remember, like, yes, it's within people to people. But you know that. You know that when you're at school and the teacher says, do your homework, you're going home to do your homework to bring it into school so you don't get in trouble at school. Like, you're not. You're
I guess
not, you're
that both, caring but of whether but you get not, in trouble or not, because some people didn't.
But they're not saying.
And they didn't care. And they'll be like, my dog ate it.
Who? No one said that in
London.
Oh, no,
trust me.
No one said that in London. No one.
No, first of all,
said that
in my classroom in year four, I can sit here and tell you.
Not
the dog one. Someone said the wind blew it away. I remember who it was.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Darren.
Wow.
He said, yeah, because it was the excuse that I was like, what? Literally said, like, where's your homework, Darren? The wind blew it away. And I was like, rah.
So, I was really honest. If I didn't do my homework, I'm like, I didn't do it, miss.
Really?
Got in trouble.
I
would basically go, like, if I didn't do the homework, I would find a way to at least try and do it last minute. If I didn't do it last minute, I was like, well, it just didn't get done.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm so
it's just.
I remember the time I didn't get do my homework. What was actually homework? It was like, I was like a big woman. I was like in year 10. And then I had to tell I told another teacher to go and tell the teacher because I was really scared. I was like, oh, I always do my homework. Like, I'm not one. I never really miss my homework like that. And then someone had to go and tell Miss Agvila, who's like my favorite teacher in the world, that I didn't do her homework. And I was like, can you go and tell her because I can't do it? And it was before the class because I was so scared. And she was like, I didn't want to disappoint her, you know?
What? At the end of the day, I did all my...
That was my woman, man. That was my mum from...
When I got to secondary school, I didn't even do homework at home. I did homework. I stayed, did the homework, and then I went back home. I got, like, you know what I mean? There was no... There's no point. Like, my house was busy.
I love school, man.
Too many people. But glory be to God. It was very interesting. I just found it a very interesting story.
I didn't like it at all.
It's an interesting story just because it was so simple. It was like, you know, it was just something. It was so regular.
She works in this
really mediocre place.
She's trying
really
to change herself
position,
for him a little bit.
And she's having really mediocre sex with him. And
really? Was it mediocre?
Yeah, she said it was good, but it wasn't great.
Oh, okay.
But then she smiled over it like it was amazing.
Oh no, girl, come on.
And yeah, she did all that stuff. And it just makes you, it just made me wonder, like, about.
This is what every woman's doing, going through, man. Well, most women, anyway.
Poor things, you know what I mean?
Ladies.
And the final story.
Do not be settling, like, and glory be to God.
And Bridget Jones. The final story.
Story.
I think Bridget Jones got pregnant in the end, didn't she?
For the wrong baby daddy.
It all moved kind of crazy, didn't it?
Well, in the film, it's the right baby daddy. In the movie, it's the wrong baby daddy.
Okay.
I love the whole Bridget Jones, like all three of them.
You watched them? You read them?
No, I didn't read them. Okay. But I love watching them, all three of them.
I've never seen them.
What? Okay, we're having a Bridget Jones marathon.
It looked really wet. You know when it looks like it smelt? You know when it looks like it smells of.
First of all, you need to be careful what you say.
You know, it smells of dampness. That's what it looked like. It looked damp.
Bridget Jones looks damp.
It looked damp.
Like
the,
wet
the
cloth.
The film looked damp. Like you know.
Like a mop.
You know, yeah, like a, you know, like, how can I put it?
A flannel.
How can I put it? You know when it's like.
And you're squeezing it out and you're like, right, it's still
no,
wet.
No, you know, like, you know when you wash clothes.
Yeah, and that damp smell.
And there's a damp smell.
After you've left it for too long and you haven't hang it out.
But like, it looks like, but
you, I know what that
you
smells
can't
like.
Be asked to put it down. So the whole room just smells damp.
And then, you're, and even later on, when it's dry, it still smells
yeah,
damp.
Yeah, and everything. Because every time.
I feel and you like, have to wash it all over and, again.
Yeah, or the dampness when you
with
come
Febreze.
Out of the rain. Febreze, even. And no, even that, like, when you're trying to do Febreze when you actually need incense. Because right? It keeps to kill the scent.
Kill the scent.
Because it's dry. And basically, when you see, when I was looking at the, when I, every time I watch a Bridget Jones
Bridget
advert,
Jones.
She was always wet and in the rain. Yeah. And talking about, oh my God.
You smell like the damp from clothes that have been left. Nope. You are a colonial mess.
I am not watching.
No,
darkness.
I. No, you
I'm sorry.
You have to
I've
watch
decided.
I love Bridget Jones.
I'll try and
it's
watch it.
It's actually really, really funny.
I'll try and watch it.
Anyways,
so the volcano.
We have to watch it together. So the last book is the last story. It's called What is a Volcano? And it's my favorite story.
So this story centers around the myths of certain elements within African folklore. With an ant and river gods and many, many, many other elements.
Okay, first of all, whatever. So,
but it does though. That's what it does.
So basically this story, let me do that again because I don't know what the hell Alex was doing.
I was doing my best BBC voice.
BBC voice. BBC. So anyways, this story is told from a narrator who, I would say it's an omniscient narrator who narrates the feud between the ant god and the river goddess. And it's basically a feud. I don't know what. Well, basically, I'll read you the first paragraph. It says, "The god of ants and the goddess of rivers were feuding. Their feud was in the early stages, more a cause for rolled eyes and snickers than alarm. River had divided one of her streams, and the new current washed away a small anthill of no real consequence, except Ant had grown especially fond of this fledgling colony."
So she's trash.
"He complained first to the goddess of hearts, legendary for her sympathy, then to the god of vengeance, known for his, well, vengeance. Ant approached many other deities, trying to talk them onto his side of things. But those who did not smite him simply laughed, for Ant was the most minor of the gods, hardly more than a spirit. And who even knew there was a god of ants? Did you?" Anyways.
That was so trash. I was like, I didn't know there was a god of ants. Let's keep reading.
Right?
Let's keep reading the story.
One, that reading was awful because I was like trying to find the page.
It was funny. You could have just read from my book.
Oh, okay.
But.
And I kind of memorized
so,
a bit.
So Ant had an insecurity issue. And
oh my God.
He didn't.
Give me the book because there's a part where it's like. Ant had small man syndrome, low key, like man syndrome.
He said, "Oh, you never steal small things from
small
people."
From small men. I literally died. She literally said, "You don't steal small things from small men."
It's here.
And Ant got really pissed off because, like,
you washed away the anthill
for nothing. She was just like, "Today
she's
I'm just gonna."
She's like, "I'm just gonna do this." But then, so the story. What, do you want to read it?
"Such a small man with small concerns, but a fun diversion for such a woman as she." This is like, I'm just gonna annoy a short man today. But let's be serious about this story because it is my favorite of the collection.
It basically articulates what you can't treat people in a particular way just because you have a certain level of power. You can't be so condescending to certain people because that story basically talks about River. Every time River was asked about Ant, she would laugh condescendingly. Like, I've never, you know what I mean? Yeah. An ant would grow vengeful.
To the point where
River has twins as children
Ant
takes vengeance on her by kidnapping the kids and something really terrible happens to one, and you know, throughout time River goes out trying to look for her daughters.
And time as in thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah, and her sister, who is a half god, becomes the like becomes Bereva, and like so River really loses her will to start looking for her children, yeah. And then Bereva takes up the mantle trying to find it. So basically, you've got River, Life, whose sister is Grief, and Grief tries to find these kids,
yeah,
these children,
and they are hidden. And Ant also goes in hiding as well.
With the humans.
with humans. So takes up human form and, you know, takes lovers here and there and stuff and moves forward in life.
He has the immortality, so he's out here being
living
a
living his life. However, I do agree. And I think this, honestly, one of the best short stories I've read, because it really shows her talent. Because I don't know about you, but when she mentioned Ant God, River God, in your mind, how did these beings take form? They weren't human, right? In your eyes. But if they weren't human, what were they?
At first, I thought that they were, I pictured them as what they said, a river and an ant.
Yeah.
Then it grew, and I've pictured River with like long blue kind of like shawls and
With
the crown, and she was black and she was human.
Okay.
But she was very like a part of nature and kind of like the river and all these different things.
Yeah.
And she kind of lived around the water and all that. Whereas Ant lived among the earth with like
dirt and I saw him very much underground.
Yeah, like he's very proud of his people and his family, really wants to protect them. But they're constantly being belittled and looked down upon and all these different things. And I think that it was a great story, but looking at that, just looking at, you know, envy and belittling and just the way that in the end the story kind of gets passed down, and you know, I think there's a bit where Ant kind of crushes the truth into a stone and puts it into a ring and then gives it to, because he's on the run from Bereva and River, so they're going to be running for eternity, every 300 years.
Yeah.
And do you know what made me think of?
What?
So Vampire's Diaries, yeah.
Oh God,
okay,
here we go.
So I'm back on
can
this
we,
again.
Can I just, do you have to talk about Vampire Diaries?
No.
Now? Okay, let's make this quick.
I'm going to make this very, very quick.
Okay.
So basically, the original vampire family are running away from their dad
for
how many years?
Yeah.
And this is what it kind of reminded me of.
Yeah.
Like, they're going to be running away from each other for how many years? I'm thinking, how far can you run forever?
You can run forever.
Around the world.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, like, but these are gods. And I'm just like, this is just
what
crazy.
I really loved about this was the idea of how actions can become big, big things, and how something very, very small can become something that the effects of a very small thing can be felt throughout history and throughout time.
Yeah.
Because essentially, River in the beginning didn't need to like wash out that colony of ants. There weren't a lot of them. For her, it was something very stupid. It was an afterthought. And I think afterthoughts become main priorities if what you do harms them in a way. So I think what this story, this myth, this fable even, what it demonstrates is to ensure that you really think about your actions and how they affect other people, small as they might be. And because you don't know what that particular thing means to somebody else. So, I mean, Vampire Diaries, for instance, you know, I would say, oh, he's just watching it now. He doesn't know what it means. Like, okay, like he's just watching it, blah, blah. I've watched Vampire Diaries since sixth form, like when it started, actually. And it has been a major thing in my life. So when, I don't know, when you were cussing off someone, I think Esther Michelson.
I wasn't cussing off Esther. Or someone, Elena.
Was it Elena? Anyways, so when someone, no, you were cussing off Esther because you were like, oh, no, you didn't know that Alaric was basically kind of became an original because he was turned by the original like mother. Anyways, so when I heard of that, I was like, this trash, you, do you know what I mean? That pains me a little. But for you, you're just watching a show. So that's just me showing an example of how priorities and how things matter differently for people. And I think you need to be really understanding. And River wasn't, and she felt the ramifications of her actions, of her very small actions, centuries, thousands of years afterwards. What I also really love about this story is the reason why I asked you how did these characters take form in your mind was because the first time I read it, because they were so, this story was so different from other stories in that it didn't talk about humans, my imagination was literally like in havoc, because I was like, well, how do I, where are the personification lines? How do I personify this? And then I was like, this is beautiful, because the moment you render my imagination, like, there is no logic to it, and I have to start building blocks all over again in your writing, it was like, whoa.
I positioned them in the same way that I positioned the Anansi stories in the Anansi Boys.
Yeah, I didn't read them.
Very good stories in the Anansi Boys. It was very interesting, just because they take human form, but on the godly plane, they take the form of the animal.
I see.
So,
you can form that in your mind, animals. However, rivers.
But that's what I mean.
We know, like, rivers, but do we know the river god and how the river god looks like?
But I mean. But you can think of Poseidon and think, yes, he's, but the, you know, sea god.
Poseidon, like in the films, Poseidon takes the form of a human, sometimes larger, sometimes just the sea moving about, sometimes it's a small human. But so, with this, I was, because she didn't explain and she didn't describe it in a way like this is how they are formed, my imagination was trying to catch onto something on the page that could allow me to ground down my image of the character. And she started doing that slowly. And I think that is what was so amazing about this, because sometimes I would see it as ants, and it wasn't this one thing. It was a stream of consciousness that was very conscious. She knew exactly what she was doing. It read like normal prose. However, the imagining of the characters was very stream of consciousness, because I couldn't place them. I could just hear their voices. Yeah. Sometimes I'd grasp a look of them here and there. And I also wanted to touch on, I just wanted to ask whether all of these types of myth and stuff and these types of stories, Alex, they exist in, I would say, the other narrative, the narrative of the other. And I don't see them apart from like very, very old Aesop type fables. In Western narratives. Do you think that we view these narratives now as almost primitive, and that it's something that the African/African Caribbean diaspora or the people on the ground, they need to, I guess, evolve to like other types of writing? Or is it, because a lot of the times when we speak of these things, we speak of them as like these past things. Oh, it's a past type of narration. It's a past type of storytelling. And with that, there, it's almost inferior. And I don't like that.
Do you know what? With those stories, I think that it depends on, it's when they're told and how they're told.
Right.
So when you're told that story, if you told this story to a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old, they're going to inhabit it in a different way than if you retell that story to them at 20. Do you see what I mean?
But why? So,
because the meaning, because the meaning in those fables and folklore and all those different native stories, they have a particular meaning, and they're told to get a message across.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, and it's, you know, a lot of the time they're told so that they can be accepted and be palatable by our kids. So kids will learn the story of the ant and the river and the river, but then as they grow older, they'll start to understand the philosophy behind the ant and the river, right. and it will give them lessons on how to teach it. So that's kind of the importance.
You're saying that
of
this is
Aesop's fables.
These types of stories should be told to the younger generation my issue is this: it's because they are very simple, but they teach you very deep philosophical writings, right? However, you're not going to give a child Hegel to read to understand
because
the meaning of life. You're going to give the, you're going to tell them a fable or a story. So in a way, we are kind of saying that this is a very simple way of understanding the world. No,
no, I don't think it's very simple, because you could, like, you can give somebody Hegel, but will it be interesting?
Absolutely. Well, not. I think Hegel is interesting, low key.
No, I hear Hegel and I think dry.
Nah, you need to read it. It's kind of dry.
But they're probably lessons within that that have been told in various different ways.
Absolutely.
So basically, but the thing is, when you start to shroud it in this kind of like protectionism of, oh, this is what Hegel said, this is Hegel's theory, rather than I understand that theory and then this is what that's, you know what I mean? Like there's different ways to tell the story. Yeah. And that's kind of what we need to understand. There are so many fairy tales. They're kind of like, they're more or less fables. Do you see what I mean? Like fairy tales, all those different things. They have to be, when they're told to kids, they're told to that they're pleasant and they're little tales that are told just so that with a message behind it. As they grow older, you kind of start to understand the importance of said story. But
yeah,
it's all about how you receive it.
Yeah, I also wanted to touch on how, just touching on this subject as well, the same subject with regards to literature, how literature has evolved in the West and how it was interrupted in the East. I don't know, in the not West, and that interruption, I think, caused a stillness that means that this evolution of writing and not even evolution but different forms of writing we haven't seen come from Africa, the Caribbean, Southern America. So for example, with like Britain and the world, there were various like literary movements, so and they're marked by shared traits of like style, subject, literary genre. And obviously literature, it might like predate these movements, but Britain, America, they've been given the liberty to establish writing, whether it's the medieval period, the Renaissance, Enlightenment, the neoclassicism, like the Romanticism, American Romanticism, Victorian, American Transcendentalism, Realism, Modernism, Postmodernism. And it just seems like really silly, not silly, but I'm also almost offended that the interruption of the imperialist movement meant that African writing, it wasn't given a platform to grow so that we can have narratives that are formed by a shared specific thing. However, I mean, I do think that it's happening now, so maybe in 20 years time you can say that, okay, in you know the 90s, you know, post like revolution, freedom or independence of these different countries, they were like busy writing this.
Yeah.
20 years after that, they were busy writing this. When the Arab Spring happened, Africa was busy writing this.
Yeah.
When Britain was going for Brexit, people were on about this in the African diaspora and people on the ground back home. So I think that we can get that now, but in 20 years time, however, we were robbed of that. And that makes me sick when I was reading this. I was like, I hope that our writing isn't just going to stay at myth.
No.
That we are going to get the philosophy that we have, essentially.
It won't, because things move. Things are transcendental and things move. And we just have to be a part of that, or just trying to like encourage that to happen.
Yeah,
I don't think anything stays in state for so long. But yes, we have come to the end of the show, guys.
Oh my god, we've talked so much because we really love the stories. Yeah. I'm so sorry. I mean, I have something to rant about. Basically, God is a Woman, Ariana Grande's latest video. I haven't even watched album. And she has a song called God is a Woman, and people were going nuts about it. Nigerian Twitter were at me because, you know, you're not a Muslim, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, bruv, like, language has pronouns and pronouns are gendered. Like, it's very easy to see. And I personally don't, like, you know, God is not a man. But however, you get really perturbed in your spirit when someone says God is a woman. I'm not saying God is a woman. God is not a woman. God is not a man. However, understand, why does someone saying God is a woman, why does it irk you? Really think about that, and then you'll understand why I'm pissed off.
But the thing is, I listened to the song, and I was like, people actually didn't listen to the song then.
No, they just saw the title, God is a Woman, and they started going nuts.
Because the song doesn't say anything other than, like, you know, all the beauty in the world, you know what I mean? Like, God is a woman, beauty is a woman. Like, what?
I think it's the idea of putting God and woman together, and woman being inferior, obviously. Like, it's just the basics of misogyny that you just don't get.
You're all going to have an issue when you go to the other side and it's a big old black woman in a head wrap. That's looking not, at you saying,
God is not.
Child. You not. Out here talking about me.
Anyways. I did not say that. Anyways.
I did. Okay.
Do we have any announcements?
I got no announcements. I have no announcements.
I have none and no announcements either.
Yeah.
We're doing bits. We out here. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Thank you so much for I'm so happy I'm back. Like, I really enjoyed recording.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week. You know where to find us. Hit us up on all the relevant streams, relevant places.
@mostlylit on Twitter, @mostlylitpod. Please comment, subscribe, like,
rate,
everything.
Rate, review,
everything. Do it all, because we love you and we really look forward to your support, and I actually really enjoy reading the comments.
Cool. See you next week.
Bye, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.